proceed?
Yes, you may. Good morning.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Vanessa Pye Thompson on behalf of Chauncey Williams, and I will endeavor to reserve 2 minutes of my argument for rebuttal.
You may.
I'd like to begin with some of the procedural issues that this case raises, as the government has argued both that Mr. Williams' 2255 motion and this appeal are barred by the collateral attack waiver in the global plea agreement that was entered into. And the government has also argued procedural default for failure to raise this challenge before the trial court and the sentencing court. We do submit that this case falls within the illegal sentence exception under both Bibler and Torres. And I think that, the government has argued that in this case, we don't fall within that those cases because we're not attacking the sentence, but rather we're attacking the conviction. And I would submit that that is incorrect. I think that this court's en banc opinion in United States versus Barron, which I apologize is not in our briefing, but I can hand the citation up or would be happy to submit.
If you want to have an additional citation, if you can just send a 28J letter, please.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And in Barron, this court explained, that in the 2255 context, what the petitioner sought to do, and this was a case where the petitioner was challenging a 924C sentence, that what the petitioner was really seeking to do was to set aside his sentence, and that as a ground to do so, he claimed that his conviction was void because it wasn't authorized by law. And that's precisely the circumstance that the court is presented with here. In this case, Mr. Williams asks the court to set aside his mandatory consecutive 84-month sentence on the 924C count, and any challenge to the 924C conviction is merely a ground upon which he relies in asking the court to set aside that illegal sentence. The government has also argued that with regard to the collateral attack waiver in this case, that the court should interpret that strictly as a contract, and the contract principles would suggest that Mr. Williams' petition and appeal should be dismissed. But Barron also gives us guidance in this regard, and I think there this court, again sitting en banc, noted that the plea agreement analogies can be helpful in assessing waivers or plea agreements and waivers, but that contract analogies are, quote, not perfect. The court noted that a plea agreement is not a commercial exchange, and further cautioned that a person's time in prison can never be restored to them, such that contract analogies don't apply exactly because the parties can't, and particularly the person who's been in prison, can never be returned to the initial position that they were in prior to entering into a contract.
What I was struggling with, because I had to like draw a little chart with all of his procedural situations,
yes.
But that is your argument that, under Blackstone, it would seem that he had violated or missed the one-year bar issue. But you say, well, no, that's not good law anymore after Davis. But Davis has not been made retroactive. So perhaps you can walk me through why we wouldn't just stop there.
Well, Your Honor, I don't have a great deal to add to briefing on that, except to say that it's a position that because Johnson dictates Davis, that Johnson and the Johnson timeline is really the trigger, the one-year timeline. And so we don't need to sort of wait for an additional case, or Mr. Williams doesn't need to refile specifically under Davis. I think that to say that would be inviting essentially waves and waves of petitions with petitioners.
Well, I mean, I hear what you're saying. If we were to dismiss it on the Blackstone ground, we would get, maybe not us, but the Ninth Circuit District Court would get another petition on this question of Davis extending Johnson too. Is that what your response
is?
Yes.
And I think it's also important to note that there weren't sort of additional kind of logical leaps or additional cases that the Supreme Court added in Davis in order to reach its holding. It is a strict application of Johnson. It is dictated by Johnson. And so I think that this is distinct from cases where perhaps the rule that comes out of a case, while informed to a great degree by prior precedent, also requires other cases in order to reach its conclusion, which was not the case in Davis. With regard to the government's argument that, you know, essentially Mr. Williams should file another petition and could ask for permission to file a second or successive petition, I don't necessarily agree that he would need to on this procedural record. I would note that if that is ultimately the way that the court goes, we'd ask the court to consider granting him permission to file that petition. Mr. Williams is...
You mean giving advance?
Yeah.
permission.
Or at least sort of... note about the propriety of that permission. And the reason for that is, really, quite honestly, in some senses, practical. I think the government has agreed that it would be appropriate to file. Mr. Williams' current projected release date is April of 2021, mm-hmm. with potentially halfway house placement and things. I think if we had to go through litigating whether or not he needs to file that, practically speaking, any potential relief would be sort of eviscerated at that point as a practical matter.
But the merits would come out the same way whether we do them now or later, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Absent intervening case law between
sure.
now and then, changing record, yes. And so, again, we'd ask the court not to treat this strictly as a contract situation. And again, I think it's important to note, and particularly in the 2255 context, is this court described in Barron that what is at stake for the parties in this type of a situation is incredibly important, and I think gives the court a reason to not apply strict contract principles, where the court in Barron noted that what's at stake for a defendant in this situation is his liberty, and by this situation I mean with plea agreements, and that what's at stake for the government is just punishment for violations of the law and its interest that an innocent act not be punished. So on the whole, we would ask the court to find that this case falls within Bibler and Torres and Barron. With regard to the government's arguments about procedural default, we would submit that Mr. Williams is excused from any default based upon both actual innocence and because he can meet cause and prejudice. Cause because this claim was constitutional claim, I apologize, was unavailable to him at the time that he was tried and sentenced in light of James in 2007 and Sykes in 2011, which Johnson then explicitly overruled. And with regard to prejudice, he can establish that there's a reasonable probability that without the error, the result would have been different because he received a mandatory 84-month consecutive sentence as a result of the 924C conviction. And while there wasn't a reply filed with this, this was all briefed in the district court. The briefing for that is at docket 13 of the habeas petition at pages 3 through 7.
Did you want to save your remaining time?
Yes, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Michael Morgan for the United States. Procedurally, this case is a mess. And there are just myriad obstacles to the court reaching the merits. I mean, the most fundamental one is that Blackstone makes crystal clear this case is untimely. I'm perfectly cognizant of the practical concerns that we're just shunting the defendant off to a second 2255, but that's the statutory scheme. The scheme is set up that way, and the defendant's argument that somehow or other, because Davis sort of followed logically on from Johnson, well, that was considered in Blackstone. It's like, this is a different rule. It's an extension of the Johnson rule to a new context. That's a new rule. So if they want to take advantage of that new rule, they need to file a second petition.
And then we'll get the same briefs we have here about whether this is a divisible statute and...
Well, that is absolutely true, and of course, the court can affirm on any ground, and if the court is inclined to reach the merits because it thinks that's an easier disposition, the government doesn't object to that. I mean, we certainly don't waive any of our procedural defenses.
I'd be interested in hearing your merits argument.
Sure. Okay, this statute everyone agrees the statute is at least divisible into two parts. The first part, which sets forth the what I'm calling the standard offense, the second part, the enhanced offense. The defense seems to be taking the position, although none of their briefing actually addresses it, that the first part of the statute is just one offense. But the statutory language makes that impossible, because it's three offenses. It's assault, it's robbery, and it's attempted robbery.
What about the second? What about the aggravated offense?
Well, we can talk about that, but you don't need to get to the aggravated offense.
I'm getting to it.
Okay.
So I'd like to talk about it, right? I'd like to talk about
okay,
it.
Okay, the aggravated offenses are also divisible because juror unanimity is required for any aggravator. Mathis and Rendon tell us that for divisibility purposes, an element is anything about which the jury must unanimously agree.
Right.
So that's also divisible. So what you essentially have is 12 offenses in this statute. The defendant was convicted of one. And since the statute is divisible, we can look at the Shepherd documents.
At what point do we look at the Shepherd documents? That's really part of my question.
Okay.
So interesting, right? Because I agree with you. There's no question. There's two, because you have a 10-year and a 25-year. So then you get to the, I think, which is the more interesting question for me, is the divisibility of the aggravated offense, and at what point can we peek there?
All right. Well, you can certainly...
It's a weird way we've already peeked.
Well, you can certainly... right. You can certainly peek at the first part, just to see whether or not it's an aggravated offense or not. And if it wasn't an aggravated offense, then you would be sort of looking at the top part. And if it's an aggravated offense, well, you can look to the aggravator, or alternatively, and the government would suggest logically, you can actually just look to the top part. Because if the unaggravated offense counts, then necessarily the aggravated offense counts. So if unaggravated robbery is a crime of violence, which we argue, then necessarily aggravated robbery is a crime of violence.
If I'm not so persuaded by your unaggravated, because we have a common law robbery definition, it seems to me then we're focusing on aggravated, and if your analysis is, which we easily do, I mean, it's easily divisible that way.
Yes.
And if we peek there and determine that he's convicted of the aggravated offense, I'm not sure why we're spending any time on this, what you call the basic offense anyway. But if you could just humor me, I'd really appreciate hearing your analysis of the aggravated offense and its divisibility and whether all three of its components qualify.
Okay. The government's position is it is divisible, again, because unanimity is going to be required for any particular aggravator. So it's divisible. So now we just look at which aggravators at issue in this case. This is a life in jeopardy case. We would take the position that wounding certainly counts. The recidivist aggravator...
Excuse me, it's a life in jeopardy case because you peaked again?
Yes, because it's divisible.
Yes.
So we're allowed...
But it's just, that's what I'm just trying to get at, if you could just...
Right.
Me again, but because, you know, you're peaking and then you're sort of peaking again. The first peak...
Right.
It's a little odd, but the first peak is to make sure that we're in the aggravated land.
Correct.
And then you're peaking again, I think, because there are at least three ways to do this, and the third is just a repeat offense of the first
that's correct.
Basic one. Mm-hmm. So we know that's different, a different
yeah.
crime.
Yes.
Okay.
So,
I'm not trying to put words in your mouth,
no.
but I am trying to follow along.
No, okay. and you're right. It is kind of like a double peak. It's a peak, and then now that we've decided that it's aggravated, mm-hmm. now we can actually go down the aggravators because we've decided the aggravators themselves are divisible. So now we can actually do the categorical analysis focusing on the particular aggravator.
Which is how you, I just don't want to skip any steps, and that's how you get to life in jeopardy.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. And so then if we're at the life in jeopardy, that is a threatened use of physical force.
So what about this notion that that this statute would tolerate a recklessness standard?
Well, that issue was decided by the court in Watson in respect to the bank robbery statute, which is materially indistinguishable, and the court read the Supreme Court's Carter decision that says that all the acts have to be knowingly. So it has to be a knowing act in Watson of intimidation, but here it would be a knowing act of placing the defendant's life in jeopardy.
So that's where you get the intentional
right,
question.
Right. And in fact, as the jury was instructed in this case, the jury had to find that the defendant intentionally, they used intimidation to as a sub in for life in jeopardy, which I'm not sure why they used that, but that's the instruction that was given. But nevertheless, the jury was instructed that they had to find the defendant acted intentionally in a manner that would put the defendant's life from an objective standpoint in jeopardy.
Yeah, well, that almost sounds like a factual analysis, though, and we're in modified categorical land.
Oh, no, so. Absolutely. I'm simply saying that the jury's instructions make clear or are evidence that, in fact, this element, the placing the defendant's life in jeopardy has an intentional requirement. It's not a negligence. You can't be guilty by negligently putting the defendant's life in jeopardy.
Right, but it's just, and I'm not trying to be a stickler, but we look, you know, under Mathis, we look at the jury instructions. Typically, we're looking like at a pattern set. You seem to be acknowledging that in this case, the instruction was modified, so it gets a little dicey to go there.
That's fine. I think I was mainly responding to the defense argument that the instructions somehow show that this case was submitted on a negligence theory, and it just wasn't. But stepping back from the instructions, I think just taking the analysis in Watson, and there's no reason not to import it here. I mean, they're both robbery statutes. They were enacted at the same time. There's no evidence that Congress ever intended for robbery to be any different. So it's an intentional crime. It's a knowing crime. You don't have to specifically intend anything, but you have to knowingly act in a way that puts the defendant's life in an objective risk of jeopardy. That suffices under Leocal. To meet the intentional standard. And I would like to circle back just quickly, even though I understand if you agree with that the aggravated counts, you can avoid the top part. But I think after Stoeckling, there's not a lot of room to argue that a common law statute doesn't qualify as a crime of violence. Stoeckling says common law robbery counts. Common law robbery included putting in fear, which is what we have here. So I don't see how, consistent with Stoeckling, you can say that a common law robbery statute isn't a crime of violence. I don't think that argument is open anymore. Unless the court has any further questions.
I do not.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So if I may, I'd like to begin kind of where we just left off. And with regard to the court's questions with respect to the aggravated offense, both about divisibility and then whether all three of the components of the aggravated or enhanced penalty clause cover. So with regard to divisibility of the second piece and sort of the Shepherd documents and when do we look, I do agree that we have this sort of, it is always an odd posture where you have a statute that is very clearly, because of the different penalties, divisible into multiple offenses. And then there remains the question of, are each of those offenses then further divisible? And so I think that the court will...
But why aren't they here? I mean, your time is ticking. Why aren't
yes.
they? They look pretty divisible to me.
Well, Your Honor, I think that actually that the case of the government brought up of Knight in its supplemental briefing, and it addressed it at 20 to 22 of its supplemental briefing. I think that, frankly, that Knight provides, and the government even says in its briefing that viewed in isolation, the language could be construed as stating that 2114A includes a single aggravated crime and that wounding and life in jeopardy variants are just means of satisfying this aggravated element. And so I think that where we have a statute where you have three different things listed, and one of them is simply a recidivist offense, and as the court noted, you can kind of easily peel that off, and where we have an analysis that focuses on the facts that juries have to unanimously find as sort of the touchstone.
Again, time is ticking. So what you're doing with the aggravated offense is dividing it into, not into thirds, but into two-thirds and one-third. That's
correct.
What you're doing.
Correct. And I don't think that our briefing, at opening brief, clearly did that, but I think that Knight supports that.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, we got that. And again, we apologize to the court and recognize the record here could be more clear.
So that, since that's your argument, just
yes.
help me out with that.
Yes.
That you want me to decide that the two-thirds of the aggravated offense is not divisible, so what's your best shot?
Yes, Your Honor. So I think that, and frankly, Knight supports that proposition. And the government has said that it's not aware of any case that says that means can be sort of separately divisible within a statute. I am not either. I am also not aware of any case that says that it can't be or that they can't be, and the government hasn't cited any case for that. And so I think that where we're dealing with means that would fall outside of Apprendi, and then one that would fall within an exception to Apprendi. I think that it is sensible to say that where there are reasons to find that the factual means that have to be found by a jury are indivisible, that the presence of something that is an Apprendi exception doesn't render them or doesn't sort of eviscerate that the ability to find them indivisible.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The case argued, Williams versus United States, is submitted. Thank you both for your argument this morning.